Everything you just said was wrong.
Under state law, it is legal to remove someone trying to disrupt town meeting.
You got the stick. He just got point of order.
Gotcha. All right. Bureaucracy. So we talked about the fact that every major existing structure that is of significant operates with bureaucracies just because it's easier in terms of functionality. But of course, there's a huge difference between public and private bureaucracies in that public, as in government bureaucracies, don't exist for the bottom line, and they give tremendous amount of protection to the employees of the bureaucracy. So again, I gave you the example of the rubber room in New York. It's very difficult to fire government employees if they are in the unions. Private sector, not as much, because private companies, private bureaucracies focus on the bottom line. So efficiency and low cost. But again, in terms of operation, they do function the same way. All right, now here's the interesting thing. Under the Constitution, be it the United States Constitution or the Constitution of the Commonwealth, there's actually little language in terms of the bureaucracy. The constitutions don't say to the executive, create this massive bloat structure underneath you. It actually doesn't really say anything in particular. But all governors in every single state do have the authority to supervise any agencies that are put underneath the executive branch. So what does that mean? That means they don't micromanage. They don't like go in and do the day-to-day operations. But they may require reporting. They may require budgets. You know, so there is some type of oversight. Governors may also implement, to a degree, policy. You know, telling the agencies how he kind wants or she wants them to run vis-a-vis executive orders. Of course, governors also nominate the top-ranking officials in each of the bureaucratic agencies. Although, of course, as we know, in Massachusetts, there's that governor's council that our governors have to contend with. And every single state nomination process is different. There are also other positions, though, within the bureaucracy. So, most of them report to the governor. But of course, that doesn't mean the governor necessarily controls everything that's below him or her. So for instance, in Massachusetts, back in 2006, Boston joined the Department of Homeland Security's Secure Communities program. And under that, by signing on to it, if you get fingerprinted in Boston, your fingerprints get transmitted to the FBI as well as the Department of Homeland Security's database for cross-referencing. So like if you're on a terrorist watch list, you will get red flagged. But interestingly enough, even though Boston signed on to it, in 2011, Governor Patrick actually came out publicly against secured communities. Despite the fact that Boston had a lot of crime going on it back then. There were homicides, there were sexual assaults, and a lot of them were being committed, and this is 2011, by illegal immigrants. So, had the governor allowed things to operate, a lot of that crime would have been detected, and it was possible that those people could have been shipped off to ICE. But ironically, the mayor at the time,
Tom Menino, he came out and basically told the governor to go pound sand. Because as mayor, he was more interested in protecting the citizens of Massachusetts and the legal residents of Boston from this wave of crime. Now, I mention this old example because this time around, both our governor and the mayor of Boston, the current holders of those seats, both came out and said they're not going to cooperate with the federal agencies. So it's going to be interesting to see what develops politically in the next year or two, because my guess is that the Trump administration will slash all discretionary grants to the Commonwealth and use money as leverage against Massachusetts.
Yeah, I would imagine that.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll end up seeing what happens. But again, this is a political issue, and again, it's ironic that it had happened here just 12, 13 years ago. And that was when Obama was president, which was weird because Deval Patrick and Barack Obama were friends with one another. And so I remember thinking at the time, and that's the reason why I put that example in my notes back then, was because it was odd, because you would think Democrat would kind of work together.
Yeah, this is kind of reminding me like what's happening right now in Boston. Though. Like there's a bunch, like there is still crime going on in Boston though right now.
There's a tremendous amount of crime going on in Boston, and it's not being reported. And the saddest thing is a lot of the crime is taking place in immigrant communities.
Mm-hmm.
And the immigrants themselves, because many of them are illegal, are fearful to report the crime that is happening to them because they're afraid that they're going to get identified and deported. So again, there's no perfect solution to this other than I think we all should just want to make sure that the laws of the state and the laws of the country are followed. And then if there needs to be policy revisions, you know, that's a discussion for politics. All right. Getting back on this, here is the thing. Even though the governor may appoint the executive heads of these bureaucratic agencies, in terms of actual policy enforcement, it's very often that the executive officials actually have discretion in most instances, on how to do their job. So, for instance, let's say that there is an environmental regulatory agency that does inspections of contaminated water sources. Well, even though in the policy and the law that creates the agency, there may be specific penalties for violations of the rules. Well, the degree that the penalty is imposed, that's decided by the executive in the agency. You know, maybe it's a business that owns the site and they weren't responsible for the contamination. They bought it and it was already contaminated. The so-called brownfield sites. Well, you can't punish the new landowner to the level of somebody who owned the land and contaminated it. That would not be fair. Although the regulations basically say, if you try to make use of contaminated land and you don't do the mitigation, then you will be penalized. Well, the discretionary decision comes in. Do I impose a minimum? Do I see to work with them to help correct the problems? Or do I bring the gavel, you know? It's up to them. There is discretion. All right. Now, there is something that you need to remember first that I really got to edit this because I got too much words on the screen. There is a big difference between the people who the governor appoints, the political appointees, and the lifers. The people who've been working in that agency for their whole career. And the differences are twofold. By the way, in Massachusetts, the governor appoints about 2,500 people as the major heads of all the different agencies. The political appointees are not subject to civil service laws. So they don't have to go and take the test. They don't even have to be knowledgeable. They don't have to be qualified to oversee the department. They could just be political hacks. Doesn't matter. The governor has the right to appoint whoever she wants into the head positions. Of course, many of them subject to the consent of the governor's council. But the senior civil servants who have been there for their careers, to get the job, they had to take the test. And in certain instances, to get promoted, you had to take more tests to rise through the ranks. The political appointees interact with the governor. The civil servants, though, focus on the agency. So there are many instances where the civil service people there will clash with the political appointees that refuse to cooperate with the political appointees because the civil servants think they know how to do their job because, well, maybe they've been working in the department for 30 years, whereas the political appointees serve at the will of the governor, so they come and go. So ironically, I was listening to a podcast on my way here, and I don't mean to give you a federal example, but it's an easy example to understand. So, among the department heads and the executive officials that President Trump is going to appoint, he's going to appoint, or he already nominated, a guy by the name of Pete Hegseth, who is... had been a commentator. I think he worked for Fox News. But here's the irony. He's 20-year Army. He served in Special Forces. He's the recipient of 2 Bronze Stars, which is the highest combat medals that you can get. I mean, he is a soldier's soldier. And he's focused on the mission. Well, the funny thing is he's going to get nominated to be the Secretary of the Department of Defense. Well, that Secretary doesn't have the authority to make policy for the DOD. Those are the senior civil servants. But apparently, Trump put him in there because when Trump was president last time, all of the generals undermined Trump. One of the famous examples was that Milley, who would become the Secretary of Defense for Joe Biden, he was actually negotiating with China to potentially bring in Chinese support if there was an attempted military coup after the 2020 election. He did it without the authority of the President of the United States.
How do you know that would happen?
No idea. But that he got busted for it. But at that point, there was nothing Trump could do about it. And then Biden rewarded him. Well, this time around, Trump wants to make sure that the Pentagon does not go rogue. Because I'm sure you've all heard the expression, the military-industrial complex. You know, we have corporations and military entities in our country that are really good with instigating wars for profit.
Remember, the Pentagon passed an audit in, like, what?
I don't know.
They're billions and billions of dollars.
They've not passed. I think it's, like, 30 years, if I remember correctly.
Like
I read that story. So here's a weird thing. I remember when I was your age, and there was a story that was confirmed, by the New York Times, or one of the major newspapers, that the DOD, for the leadership, was actually buying gold-plated toilet seats.
Oh, good.
Yeah, they were buying gold-plated toilet seats for the executive general's offices. And it was like in the 90s, so it was like $8,000 or $9,000 per seat. So they're not buying, like, better equipment for the soldiers. They're not buying, like, better medical tools or anything like that. They're wasting money on toilets, but they can't pass an audit. So.
Why are they allowed to just keep failing audits?
Because there's been no one above them willing to bring down the hammer.
I know. That seems like a failure of the checks and balances.
Huge. Huge. Because, you know, the sad truth is with government is... it takes effort to hold people accountable, and most of the people in government don't want to hold people accountable. So it's just not good. Oh, accountability. Oh, crap. Did you see what happened with the ballot question to audit our general court?
Mm-hmm. It got passed.
It got passed. But it didn't.
Wait, why?
Because our general court voted they are not going to allow the auditor to actually audit the general court.
What?
The audit will be conducted by the Speaker of the House.
We investigated ourselves and found we did nothing wrong.
Exactly. And even though it passed in every single House district in the Commonwealth, every single one it passed, so Democrats voted for it, Republicans voted, Independents voted for it, it was 70-something percent, Democrats and Republicans said, no, we'll let the Speaker do it. There was only like, out of the 160, only like 10 people said, no, we should do what the people want.
Isn't that like super corrupt?
You think?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. Of course it is.
If the people want that, then that's literally what we should get.
Right. Well, we'll talk about ballot questions before the end of the semester. Just because we pass a ballot question in Massachusetts, that doesn't mean the general court has to do what we want. They're allowed to manipulate it, tweak it, do whatever they can.
So instead of the state auditor auditing them, it's going to be the Speaker of the House?
Yeah, so as was said, you know, we're going to investigate ourselves and we find we did nothing wrong. It's going to be an awesome audit. Can't wait to see it.
Professor, why don't they make you do it?
As I just said, the problem is that if you bring someone in that's willing to do the work and hold people accountable, they will be attempted to be destroyed. Because people in politics don't want to be accountable. They just want to sit back and get the check.
That's lame, Professor.
It is. All right. Moving on. Now, one of the biggest problems that we have with the bureaucratic state comes with this notion right here. Protecting the people's rights. If you remember what we were talking about for the first exam, how the nature of our federalist system morphed from the Venn diagram to the layer cake to eventually the marble cake and then the socialist question cake. As those changes occurred, what started happening was government's role increased exponentially, impacting the lives of the people directly. Now, at a national level, when the framers made our Constitution and they made our national government, they never in a million years would have even contemplated it being the possibility that we as individuals would have any interaction with the national government. If you actually read the U.S. Constitution, most of the granted powers deal with the national borders, making sure we have an army, making sure we have a navy, engaging in treaties with other countries, you know, interstate commerce regulation with the Indian tribes, and so forth. They never contemplated that the government would have the ability to have an office in D.C. that could basically enter into your house. That would be unfathomable. But going back, when you had the progressives, Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, even Taft to a degree. And then you had the New Deal government, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And then you had LBJ's Great Society. We use the phrase socialism to refer to government encroachment in terms of a free society, regulating economies and so forth. And more they pass laws that allow the government to regulate your behavior and impose penalties if you violated those regulations. The danger is the U.S. government, even the government of Massachusetts or any state government, has the power to essentially destroy you. They could destroy you. They could drain your bank accounts. They could seize your house. They could seize all your assets. And they could leave you homeless on the streets. And then if they wanted to, they could incarcerate you, and in some instances, they could execute you.
For what benefit?
Whatever they want. Whatever they want to do. So how do we stay safe as individuals when the government has that capacity to unleash such destruction? Well, ironically, whenever the government started getting big and encroaching, there usually was a public backlash. People began calling their congressmen, calling their representatives, calling their senators, and kind of doing the WTF question. Why are you allowing this to happen? And so what happened was at time, again, depending upon the political pendulum, the legislature would respond by passing measures to try to impose barriers on the ability of the government to essentially destroy you. But again, when the government's not even willing to audit itself, honestly and truly, how do you know that if the government calls you up and suddenly audits you? Have any of your parents ever experienced an audit by the IRS?
Not that I remember.
Oh my God. It is. You have to get an accountant. It costs thousands and thousands of dollars. And if you don't produce every last little receipt that they're looking for, they have the ability to impose thousands and thousands of dollars of fines on you.
But the state doesn't have to do that.
The state has a Department of Treasury as well. The state can do it as well. So it's not a safe position, I guess you could say. So how do we make sure they don't go too far? Well, one of the biggest mechanisms of accountability in terms of government action, and by the way, this is true on your local government as well, is laws that have been passed both at the federal level and at the state level dealing with freedom of information. Freedom of information gives us, the people, the ability to access government information.
Open meeting law.
That's part of it. So, if the government has a meeting and notes are taken, and by law notes have to be recorded, the minutes, those minutes need to be accessible by the public. If there's an instance of potential chicanery, shenanigans, tomfoolery, you have the ability to do a document request. You can request policies. You can request emails. So last year, our school got into a little bit of controversy because they hosted an event called Connections. They had a conference, and they brought in a bunch of controversial speakers that aligned on the left wing of the ideological spectrum. But one of the most controversial of them all, they brought in a drag queen who did a performance in the school library that was attended by kids as young as 7th and 8th grade. They were middle schoolers in the room. Well, the problem is that there was no communication with the, because it wasn't a required, it wasn't a school event. It was like a after school thing. But there were school systems, like 60 schools, that bus kids in to attend it. Well, no documentation was sent out giving the full itinerary. There was allegations that they were paid and they used taxpayer dollars for what was basically dubbed to be a private event. And there was like a whole bunch of cover-up. Well, there was a bunch of parents that got angry, and they began filing Freedom of Information Act request after request after request. And some of the parents actually received all of the email communication between the teacher who was running it, the principal at the high school, and the entity that brought in the drag queen. Well, that's what you can do. If something happens in your government, you have a right to access that information, and legally it has to be provided for you. There was an audit that was done, and the audit showed that the principal and the advisors embezzled hundreds of thousands of dollars. They were using this was over several years that
so they went looking for one thing and found another thing.
They just followed the rabbit hole.
Like when you go in for a blood test and then you find cancer by accident.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. So it was discovered that they were using school time, they were using school equipment, teachers were given prep time that they should have been using to prep for their classes, to be able to plan for all that. I mean, it was just bad. But it wouldn't have started, it wouldn't have been discovered, but for concerned parents who were angry what they heard and wanted to know what was up. The superintendent ended up she resigned. She left out of embarrassment. And the principal's still under contract, and they're working on getting him out.
Good.
Do you have to have, like, an actual case, like with the drag queen and all that stuff, to, like, press charges or, like, get information out from the school?
No, if you hear something, there's a form you can, you usually go to your town clerk, and you put in a request, but you have to be specific.
Public records request.
Yeah, you have to be very specific in terms of what you're requesting. You just can't say, like, I want it all. No, if you want to get emails, you have to say, I want emails from this person to this person under this time frame. Or if you want a policy, you heard about there was a discussion at a meeting and you want to get access to what was the policy draft. Again, it was referenced in this public meeting, I want this specific policy. And by law, they have to give it to you.
But if you don't say it right, they can't give you anything.
Well, that's the thing. It has to be specific.
Somebody took a article or something out of another article last night. They took one thing out of it and the moderator had them write it down on paper and then bring it up, but it wasn't word of rights. They had to rewrite it, and you got to have this specifically under this act,
yep.
This, rewrite this until like 20 minutes.
Everything has to be precise.
Yep.
All right. Open meeting law. By law in Massachusetts, all meetings of government agencies and entities have to follow open meeting laws. Now, it's kind of a misnomer. It doesn't mean that it's a public hearing that everyone can go in and say what they want to say. No, it's not like a Facebook forum. What open meeting law requires is that the public is allowed to come in and view. So they're not given the right to participate. They have to be able to view. Yes. So what does this mean? Well, most town agencies satisfy open meeting law by recording the meeting and broadcasting it. Because if it's on the TV, then other eyes can watch. The only time you can have a closed door meeting, and that's known as an executive session, is if you're dealing with potential litigation, you know, someone suing the town, or you're doing contract negotiations. But even those meetings, minutes have to be recorded, and the minutes have to be made available to the public. Both at the federal and at the state level, many states have what's known as whistleblower protection acts in place. So if there is somebody who works for a government agency, and they are witnesses to wrongdoing, they legally can go forward to the public and report fraud or corruption or waste, and they can't be fired. They cannot be terminated. There can be no retaliation. But in this modern era in which we live, it's very rare that whistleblowers come forward, because there's other ways to get you. Well, yeah, they could kill you.
Just kill you.
Yeah. I mean, they could disappear you. But there are also other things to take into consideration. Do you want to step forward and run the risk of having your entire backstory, all of your social media posts, anything that you've ever shared, suddenly become to the attention of the public? There's often retaliation. I know of a situation where I had a buddy that was on the school committee in another town, and he wanted to put some pressure to just do like a budgetary deep dive to make sure money wasn't being wasted, kind of like what happened to us. And he had kids in the school, and next thing you know, his kids started failing classes. You know, so So there are consequences to every action. But at least the individual has the ability to have some type of defense. But just because they do that doesn't mean they're going to be confident enough to do it.
So it's not really protection. It's more you can't fire the whistleblower.
Right, you can't fire, but I probably will be miserable for the rest of my working career.
So sorry to hear about your upcoming suicide of 27 bullets.
Exactly. All right. So how do you control the bureaucracy then? If they have all of this power, and even those these laws, you know, don't really insulate us from them. Well, it's challenging. It's challenging. But truth be told, all three branches of government do play a role. So, for instance, we know the checks and balances. So let's put it this way. Let's say that the general court finds out some state agency isn't doing its job. The gen court can pass a law that strips that agency of its entire budget. So it's still on the books, but if there's no operating money, then basically it shuts down and the whole staff is laid off. The governor, don't forget, the governor's proposed the budgets, but the government also does the appointments. So if there's an agency that's not behaving, well, the governor can remove the top appointee and put someone else that maybe is going to be prepared to do a deep dive. But hands down, probably the greatest check of the courts. If your rights are violated by a government agency, you have the ability to appeal any decision that that agency makes against you, maybe not death, but short of death, and take that agency to court. And there will be a full trial on the subject matter. So they will look to see if the agency stepped out of bounds, if the punishment was beyond the policies, the regulations, or maybe the regulation itself is unconstitutional. You never know where it could end up. But the goal essentially is ultimately to create a system that can deliver the services that the people want without encroaching too much on your freedom and your pocketbooks. Questions? All right. Here's a nice little essay question.
What are the six major activities that all bureaucracies engage in, but particular, more precisely, government agencies?
Well, activity number one, they exist to engage in law enforcement or manage programs. It's not the governor, it's not your senator that's going and handing out like maybe welfare or providing food at the food pantry. You know, it's these agencies that are in charge of doing this. And their job is to do whatever they're created for. So our Department of Revenue collects state taxes. Our Postal Service delivers the mail. State Police patrols the highways. They're created for a purpose and that's what they're supposed to do. Now, in terms of how do they go about their day-to-day business? Well, you would want to think that these people are the subject matter experts. So what happens very frequently is that these different agencies also develop policies under which the agencies operate. You know, it makes sense that if it's the state police that is looking for drug trafficking on the highway, you know, those are the guys and gals who boots are on the ground. They kind of know what they've seen. So maybe they can suggest certain policies that, you know, make that process easier. Or in the sense of health and human services. You know, if you have people that are in charge of restaurant food inspection, you know, you would think that they kind of know what they're talking about. So maybe they would suggest new storage policies or new materials that are deemed to be safe for cleaning, things along those lines. They're also in charge of making their own rules and regulations. So, Massachusetts has it on the books that if you get pulled over and the stopping officer believes that you are operating under the influence of a controlled substance, then they have a right to engage in kind of like breathalyzer actions. You know, they're going to evaluate whether or not you are intoxicated. Well, what do the rules say? Well, very simple. Cop thinks you're drunk, he's going to get out and he's going to make you kind of walk the line. He might make you, you know, well, when would you give that field sobriety test to somebody? Well, the police agencies have made their regulations. And the officers are trained in those circumstances in which to do so. Because if you think about it, I'm going to give you a really off-the-wall example that makes no sense, but it works. If the cop is giving you a parking ticket because you didn't put money in the meter, does it make sense that he's going to make you engage in a field sobriety test?
No.
No, because that's not relevant to the situation. So when are the circumstances when that type of enforcement mechanism is used?
You're swerving around the road.
Yeah, or?
Driving too fast.
Or?
Try
too slow, right?
Slurred speech.
Slurred
making
speech.
Too much sense.
Yeah, making too much sense.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Or how about when they you put down the window? And
smell.
You can smell it.
My
they just stink all the time.
They were driving down, like, you know, like 75 miles per hour, and they see this stuff keep coming up. It looks like they're spraying, you know, and they spray the windshield wiper stuff, and you see the fluid. And like, boy, sure, it's weird. They keep spraying the windshield fluid, and we're not getting wet. And then they start to smell weed. And it's just these huge clouds coming from this guy's car.
It's freaking Cheech and Chong some days.
And he pulls over, and he's like huffing another one, like full on.
Yeah.
Brother,
it's insane.
The road. Why would you drive like that?
But so in that circumstance, the rules in which the cops would engage in the correct behavior to determine if they are stoned, you know, that has been policy developed in the department, and it's been trained. Yeah, it's been trained by, well, there's something called a plain view doctrine. So if the police see you doing something that's illegal, that's probable cause. Yeah, exactly. Here's another thing. So let's say there is a law. Well, when should it be applied? Well, that's the bureaucracy. They're allowed to make those type of decisions. So, now, of course, obviously, there is no circumstance where every possible tangent can be thought of. And like I said previously, these agencies do have discrepancy. But ultimately, it's up to the agencies themselves on how to engage in their business. So, what happens if the government thinks you're doing something wrong? Well, it depends. They could come in contact with you many different ways. You might receive notice in the mail. Maybe someone is going around doing site visits and knocks on the door. Typically, government tries to do so in a friendly manner that doesn't result in people getting all worked up. Sometimes they engage in consultation. Sometimes they engage in negotiation. You know, they don't go to the nine, you know, right out of the gates, usually. Sometimes disputes are settled by what's called private letter rulings, where you're allowed to go and you make your case before the agency. And they don't make you come back in, but they just put something in the mail. So, for instance, I'm trying to think of something that happened to me, or following the circumstance. So, when I put my shed in my backyard, when I measured it to make sure I followed all of the right zoning laws in Sutton, any structure that doesn't have electricity in it has to be 10 feet off the boundary. Well, when we put the shed in, there was no power inside, But then before the final inspection came, my electrician ran a plug and put it on the outside of the shed, just kind of as like the end of where my my little pool, my above ground pool is, just because he was running conduit as well. So technically, when I dropped the shed, it didn't have electricity, and I didn't intend it to. But it took so long for the town inspector to come, it was like 6 months later, that's when the plug got put on. So he came, and he's like, you didn't say that it had electricity. And I'm like, well, when I put it on 6 months ago, it didn't. Why does it have electricity now? He goes like, well, my electrician just did it for free. Well, he didn't find me. I just got a letter basically saying, we acknowledge that under your original permit, you know, you didn't put in for electricity, but we also acknowledge the circumstance now that it does have power on the outside. But do not wire the inside. He actually wrote that out. So he's going to let me slide, but I can't push my luck. Because now that that's documented, if anyone ever came back and inspected the shed, they will see that reference in the system, and they'll know that I disregarded the leniency that I received. All right. What happens if it's wicked severe? Well, agencies also go to court. Many of these government agencies have staff attorneys working for them. So, for example, I just read about this in the newspaper not long ago. Yet another agency that is very, very corrupt, apparently, the Cannabis Control Commission. They can't keep staff members. They can't keep commissioners. But they do have multiple attorneys that work in-house. So if you're ever looking to start a pot shop and you are suspected of violating state regulations, the Cannabis Control Commission can actually take you to court and possibly pull your license and shut down your business. Most agencies do have attorneys working as well in-house, so just be mindful of that. But at the same token, like I said previously, if the agency punishes you too severely, you also can go to court. You can sue the agency, and they have to go to court and defend themselves. So you would be the plaintiff. You would be suing them.
What would be grounds for too severe of a punishment?
Let's say that you are running a business and you've passed all your inspections and you run a very meticulous business, but the inspector comes in to renew your license and notices that out of the blue, not noticed before, you had a plug that was a half an inch too close to the sink. And the moment he noticed that, he pulls your license. So he shuts your business down. There would be nothing in the policy that said, okay, a plug is a half inch away, too close to a sink. So now he's going to shut down your entire business. So what you do, you'd go sue to get your license back, and you probably want some type of punitive damages imposed. Because the time your shop was shut down, you're losing your customer base, you're losing your profits, you can't pay your bills, and so forth. How's that?
It's a good example.
That's pretty good, right? All right, any questions on the six activities? All right, moving forward. What other fun stuff do we have in here? Oh, budget! Budget. We already know because we've talked about it. You know, obviously, what the general court does with its funding, they don't want it to become public. But eventually it will get out there. But hopefully once it does, the people who deserve to be punished are punished properly. But in terms of budgeting, our Constitution actually requires that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts operate under what is deemed a balanced budget. A balanced budget. What does that mean, balanced budget?
You're not in debt? You're not spending more than you're getting?
Yeah. You can't spend more than you take in. It has to be balanced. We are one of the few states in the country that has this requirement. Our government is not allowed to do what our federal government does, or states like California do. We're not allowed to engage in what's called deficit spending. That's when you spend more than you take in. So theoretically, our state must be able to reconcile every last penny that comes in as revenue, and it has to equal every last penny that's paid. Now, the process is complicated, and it does take almost the entire year to complete. On any given year, the process begins in June. With respect to the ending of the fiscal year, in Massachusetts, June 30th is the end of the fiscal year. The moment you get to that point, the governor's office begins working on the next fiscal year budget. But they can't do it until they get to that process or that date. Because the moment the fiscal year ends, the state will be able to see which accounts have money left over and which accounts are short. So the first thing that it does is it reconciles. If you have line items in the budget where there's extra money left over, you take that money and you apply it to those line items that are short. So an easy one to understand, and this is what every city and town and state also has to deal with, is when winter time comes around, you put in your budget an estimate on how much you're going to spend on road clearing. How the hell in June can you tell how many days it's going to snow? And how much salt you're going to need? And how many drivers do you need?
Is it the average?
Well, that's what you do. You try making a reasonable prediction.
Like the flu vaccine.
Based on past years. Well, the problem is look at the winters that we've had for the last two.
Unpredictable and nonsense.
Yeah, we really haven't had big snow. Little snow. And to be honest with you, little snow, slush, that's the hardest conditions to deal with. Because it doesn't clean easily. And that's when most accidents, like if it's really, really cold and it's light, fluffy snow, that's the easiest snow to deal with. But, okay, let's say we have like we had last year. I think Worcester County, I don't think we even got more than 20 inches combined. So if you base the next fiscal year on this year, what happens if we have a year like we did in 2013? Where if you remember, all of you were around, every 3 days we got a major snowstorm for like a month.
It was sick.
It was crazy.
Our windows were covered, our doors were covered.
Yeah, it was just insane. I had to go out and I had to snow blow my backyard because my dog is about this big. And if I threw my dog in the snow, I would have lost him.
We didn't have dogs back then. We have to do that now.
No.
How old were you during that year?
In 2013?
Yeah.
A 40-something? I don't know.
That's awesome.
I was like 8.
Huh? No, that's what I was. I was in third grade.
I was like 10.
I just wanted to make you feel old, Professor.
Yeah, I was like either in second or third grade when this happened.
You're one of my favorites. I'm going to remember you, that's for sure. All right. So now you try making a prediction based on what we've had for the last couple of years, and this year, wham, we get walloped. Well, that could be budget breaking. So because you can't plan for it, but you've got to have a balanced budget, you need to take the extra money. So maybe you had one department that didn't work as much overtime. So you take that cash out of that particular line item, the salary line, and plug it to fill the debt gap for the snow budget. Because at the end of the day, when the final document is processed, it must be balanced. Once you get beyond that point, then the offices go to work. Within the governor's office, we have an entity called the Executive Office for Administration and Finance, the EOANF. This actually sits within the wing of the governor's department, and it's obvious what their job is because it's kind of in the name. They have to finalize the numbers. So they look at the expenditures from the last fiscal year. They also look at the appropriations from the last fiscal year, and they try looking for gaps. Then they print a report and they present it to the government. Sorry, the governor. This has to occur on or before August 15th. Because by state law, on or before August 15th is when the finalized report of the previous year is presented to the governor. And the governor is supposed to use last year's budget to plan for the next year. Over the next several weeks, you take last year's draft and you require all of the agencies to submit this year's requests. So, maybe for instance, you need to hire some more state police, but maybe you don't need as many people working in the Department of Revenue. You know, so they're supposed to go through. Maybe one department needs new computers, but maybe there's another department that has surplus equipment that they can liquidate. They're essentially, each department supposed to go through their entire operating budget and look for, again, pluses and minuses. They then make the request. The request gets matched up to last year's budget. And look, okay, one department wants an increase of 3%. Or another department wants a decrease of 8%. Well, do we have the money for both? Not only do the agencies put in their request, but all of the departments of the constitutional officers, the Secretary of State, the Auditor, the Treasurer, they have all their departments. They submit their request to the governor. The legislature, although we'll never know what's in the legislative books, they put their request in to the governor. The judiciary branch puts their request. And all of that data is put together in a preliminary draft. Questions? Once it's all plugged in, by law, the governor's office then begins holding public hearings with the assistance of the legislature. During these public hearings, the heads of all the department go before the legislature, usually Ways and Means, and basically gives mini presentations. It happens at the town level as well. So with Sutton, we have our budget hearings in February. And in February, that's when the superintendent of schools, the police chief, the fire chief, they go before our FinCom, our Finance and Warrant Committee. And they basically get bombarded with questions. Why are you buying a new cruiser? What, do you really need a new fire truck? What's this new teachers that you're bringing in, you know? The same thing at the state level. All states do this. But because they're open hearings, citizens have a right to go in and sit in. They are not public hearings, though. So you can't go, you can sit in and watch, but you can't chime in. because if I could, I would go and say, slash everything. Cut it all.
Why?
Why? Make them start over again. It's the only really way to root out all of the waste that we have in our state. You got to shut down an entire agency and build it back up again from scratch. Now, once the hearings are concluded, there is a report given to the governor. And it's filled with recommendations. Maybe there are parts of the budget that needs to be increased. Maybe there are parts of the budget that needs to be decreased. Maybe there's a need to go out and get a loan or a grant to offset some of the costs. You got to figure in Massachusetts, our state budget is like $40 billion. It's a lot of complexity to it. But does Massachusetts take in $40 million or $40 billion every year in tax revenue? In theory, it should, but that doesn't mean it all comes from taxes. So maybe they have to rebuild the bridges to get onto the Cape, the Bourne and the Sagamore Bridge. The state doesn't have the money to build those. But knowing that those are in need of repair, that gives the state opportunity to reach out to the federal government and get grants, you know, or other type of means.
Like a fundraiser.
Exactly. Now, once everything is put together in another document, all of the recommendations, all of the suggestions, all the modifications, it goes back to the EOAF for final review. The biggest item that comes out of the review is funding. Do they have enough foreseeable revenue to actually pay for the proposal? The governor then reviews it, and in December, usually right before Christmas, the governor sends the proposed budget over to the legislature. Now, FYI, the only time this doesn't occur is if it's an election year.
That's this year.
For the state, not the federal government. So in Massachusetts, 2 years from now is our election year. It'll be 2026. If we have a new governor that comes in, the governor-elect we'll go in and meet with the governor and review the budget, but the state gives the new governor 5 extra weeks to submit the document. So if the governor is in office, it has to go in by December. If it's a new governor, the budget doesn't go until February. Because it makes sense. If someone's new to the office, you got to give them a chance to go through it. Well, in Massachusetts, once it ends up in the general court, they then begin going over the budget. The moment they receive it, because all spending measures have to start with the House, a new bill is created, and it's always given the label House Bill 1. What this bill contains is all of the desired expenditures matched up with appropriations. Where's the money coming from? Where is it going to go? If it's not in the budget, it will not get paid. Now, FYI, just to keep it simple, once it gets to this point, it goes through a process identical to how a bill becomes a law. So, what does it mean? Well, It gets there, it goes to the rule committee, it gets assigned, you know, the times on how quickly we're going to get this through. Then it goes to the Ways and Means Committee. So they look to see if there's enough potential dollars to pay the potential expenditures. Then it gets submitted to some of the subcommittees where there are public hearings and there are debates. Then a proposed draft is made. And then the House does the first reading. And then they're allowed to potentially add amendments and change it. Then it goes to the second reading. Again, more tweaks, more edits. Then once it goes to the bill in the third reading, it goes over to the Senate. And it goes through the same process all over again. But at the end of the process, when you get to that point, when you have a House version and a Senate version, then there has to be reconciliation. The budget needs to be identical. Now, in speaking to several senators and several reps, the numbers are never the same. Because you get the governor's proposal, then when the House goes through it, they add their proposals. And then when the Senate gets the governor's, the Senate adds their proposals. So when you get to the point of going through all three processes, you have three distinct budgets. So what happens? Negotiations. Usually what happens is you have leaders from the House sit down with leaders of the Senate, and they try hammering out their differences between the House and the Senate. They then send that to the governor. And the governor, as I said previously, has the power to do line item vetoes in the budget. But if the government does a line item veto, the legislature has a right to override it. It's very complicated. It's very technical. But at the end of the day, when it's all said and done, when the House agrees with the Senate, who agrees with the governor, it becomes a law. And every single year, it's called the Annual Appropriations Act. And then once that occurs, and by the way, they operate on the advanced fiscal year. So yes, we're 2024, 2025, but we're currently operating under fiscal year 25. But what they're working on right now is fiscal year 26. So the budget for fiscal year 26 will get passed sometime this late spring, early summer. Question. Ooh, actually, I was off. So fiscal year 2024, the state spent $52.5 billion. So Christ, this year is probably like $60 billion. But Massachusetts ended up spending $77.8 billion in fiscal year 2024 because they ended up getting $22.6 billion in federal monies. But again, at the end of the day, state revenue plus federal revenue, that's what you can spend. Questions? All right. Let's get through as much of this as we can and then we'll call it a test. State employees. State employees. Now, there are a large number of differences to what it takes to become a public employee, and ultimately the steps to get a government job depends upon what you're doing, where you're working, and what level of government you're talking about. Are you working at the state level? Are you working in one of the departments that still have county level operations? Or are you working for a local municipality? Another distinction is, does it fall under the civil service? Now, in our MGL, Mass General Law, Chapter 31, that's the section of our state laws where you can find all the information on the civil service law. Everything that's legal about those types of gigs. In Massachusetts, teachers, police, firefighters, librarians, doctors and nurses in state hospitals, secretaries,
who work in government buildings. They all fall under the civil service umbrella. Some of them, like becoming a cop, requires you to take a test. Some of them just require extensive background checks. But in terms of procedure of hiring, firing, promotion, that's all laid out in our civil service law. The same is true at the federal level. The same is true in all of the states. Why do we have a civil service system? Well, interestingly enough, what caused the United States as a whole to push for civil service was the assassination of a president. President James Garfield was shot while waiting for a train because he was going to take his son on vacation. And the assassin was mad because he had campaigned for Garfield and he was denied the right to be appointed to, I think he wanted to be not the ambassador, but someone who worked in the American embassy in Paris.
I've heard about this guy, yeah. He was like nuts. He would like send Garfield like letters like every single day.
Yeah, I campaigned for you. I got you all these votes. I'm the one responsible for you winning, so give me a job.
He would like meet him in public and just like talk to me like, oh, hey, so one of my, have you read my letters? And he would just like completely ignore him.
Well, one of the scariest things is one day he actually got into the White House.
Yeah.
And met with them in the Oval, well, it wasn't the Oval Office then, but the old presidential office chamber.
There's a video on it. I think you should watch it.
I think you can use the GooTube, the YouTube, to do so.
All right. So, essentially, after the death of the president,
the states and the United States pushed to implement civil service laws. FYI, New York State was the first state to do so in 1883. Massachusetts was the second state to do so in 1884. So we've had it on our books for almost longer than any other state in the country. The reason why is we want to hire employees based on merit. Meaning, do they have the ability to actually do the job? Are they qualified? Because the other way is what Garfield killed. The spoils system. And it dates all the way back to when Andrew Jackson beat John Quincy Adams. Basically what Jackson did is he fired everybody that worked for the federal government and replaced them all with campaign staff. Because to the victor goes the spoils. Well, unfortunately, it's the spoil system that got Garfield killed. So now, gotta take a test. But the system has evolved. Obviously, as times have changed. Beginning in Massachusetts in the 1980s, there were efforts to reform the civil service system. Because what Massachusetts began doing is adding local positions to the civil service system. So it's not just state, there's local requirements as well. And by the way, towns with populations more than 5,000 have the right to determine who is part of the civil service or who is not. So for example, there's a movement in some of the towns to remove the police department from the civil service system. So I know Millbury has done that, Sutton has not. So what does that mean? Well, Millbury can hire pretty much anyone who wants to be a cop, whether or not they have taken the civil service exam. This allows them to bring in people who may be qualified who worked in other states. Sutton, we're still on the civil service system. So in order to become a police officer in Sutton, you must pass the Massachusetts exam. So you must be qualified by Massachusetts. You could be the most experienced cop in the world,
who works in Rhode Island. Hell, we actually have a cop that I know works in Wissahickon, who's a sergeant that lives in Sun. He could not become a sergeant in Sun unless he comes and takes the state civil service exam. But again, those are determined by town meeting votes. Generally speaking, civil service divides these government positions into two broad categories. You have officials who are the management positions, and then you have the labor service, who are the workers. And there are different qualifications for both. So an easy example that I can give you, campus security, fall within the official civil service. But the guys that make all the noise when they're raking all the leaves, they fall under the labor service. Become campus security, you got to take the civil service exam. To become part of the grounds crew, you do not. But interestingly enough, in those departments that must comply with the civil service, the top leadership positions are exempt. So in Sutton, bless you, the chief of police does not have to be qualified under the civil service laws. The town has the ability to hire anybody they wanted to. I could become the chief of police if I applied and I got appointed. Because the chief of police, yes, he's the chief or she's the chief law enforcement officer, but they don't actually have to be cops. They could be purely administrators. So they basically, you know, do the hiring, the firing, run the staff department budget, you know, does the scheduling. But they don't get into patrol cars and go out on the street and arrest people. Interestingly enough, our chief of police retired. We had someone that the town manager wanted to appoint. The majority on my board voted against the person, and now we're doing the process again, but we needed to put an interim police chief in there. So we brought in a retired lieutenant from our department. He retired like 10 years ago. So he goes in, he doesn't have a chief of police badge. He doesn't have to wear the body armor. He doesn't get to carry a gun. But he goes in, he works in the chief's office, and he usually wears it like a golf shirt, you know, identifying himself as a part of the police department. So he's an administrator, not a cop. All right. This will be the last thing, because then I got a little more than this, but I'm not going to waste your time with it, because I don't think it's on the exam. Exams. If you want to become a teacher in Massachusetts, you have to take the Massachusetts teacher exam, which I've been in favor of the exams in theory, but in practicality, they're stupid. Because if you want to become, like you say, a first grade teacher, you have to take all the subject matter tests, and you have to know as much as like a high school chemistry teacher, even though you're teaching like 1, 2, 3 ABC. So one of the issues that we have, at least I have with the teacher's exams, is they should have different exams based upon the level that you're going to teach. But Massachusetts, one size fit all. So if you pass the tests, you get qualified so you can get your license and you become a teacher. If you don't pass the test, you can't get your license, you can't become a teacher. The test to become a police officer, the test to become a firefighter, there are written exams, and there are physical components. To become a cop, for example, not only do you have to pass the written exam, but you need to be able to qualify to use firearms. Because how can you become a cop if you can't hit the broadside of a barn?
Yeah, especially if you want to be You want to join the SWAT team or something, though.
That's a whole different level. Those are the elite of the elite that qualify to do SWAT. But even SWAT, they have to take a different level exam to qualify to get into that that division. Firefighters, physical exam. You have to be able to physically be able to carry certain loads going up and down stairs, up and down ladders. You got to figure turnout gear, the equipment that the firefighters use, it's about 70 pounds of equipment. You got the heavy fireproof jacket, pants, helmet, you got oxygen tanks, you got whatever equipment you're carrying, the hoses. So if you can't pass the physical standards, you don't get to be a firefighter. But the good news is for you ladies, is that men and women have different standards. Because Massachusetts have yet to go DEI, because the requirements are based on actual biology. Generally speaking, men are bigger, stronger, faster than the average woman. So it would not be fair to expect you to carry me on your back going up a ladder wearing full turnout gear. That wouldn't make sense. So women can do other things. They have to be able to drag the weight as opposed to carry the weight. Other auditors, there's other positions that you have to take exams as well. But long story short, you don't pass the exam, you can't get the job. All right, I think that's a good place to end it because we're out of time. Your exam will open. I want to give it to you tomorrow. I do, because you have a paper due on Friday.
Yes, that's why.
That's why I want to give you your exam tomorrow.
I have another
question. We're at that point. If I kick the can down the road on Thursday, I'm starting new stuff. That will not be on exam 3. I got to start the final. So if I don't give it to you tomorrow, I'll give it to you next week. But that means we're going to have two classes of me talking about other stuff that's not going to be on the exam. You think you're going to be able to keep track of it all?
Is our final cumulative?
Do you want a cumulative final?
I'm just curious.
Do you want one?
No.
I'll give you one if you want one.
Tomorrow's good.
All right. The other thing that you need to remember is, remember that notice that I sent?
Yeah.
On Thursday, we got to meet over there. We're not meeting here.
This Thursday?
This coming Thursday.
Where were we meeting in the...
I did remember. I did a pop-up on my phone. Oh, we got to take a vote. I'll let you take a vote. You can decide. Am I going to open up the exam tomorrow? Yes?
Oh, it's ready to come.
Yep, sorry. We voted for it, so the exam will be tomorrow. Open up at 8 o'clock. You'll have until 11:59 to do it.
Professor, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. Have you ever seen Hacksaw Ridge?
Excellent movie.
Yeah, do you know how, like, there's that guy who doesn't have the gun who plays, like, Spider-Man?
254. 254A, room 254 over the administration building. If for some reason they don't need to switch rooms, I will send you an email tonight. Because I did inquire for my dean.
Can you send us the room number?
What?
Can you send us the room number email?
I did, but I'll send you another one.
Okay.
And I'll also send a reminder for you to take the test.
So it's not in this building?
No, we got to go over to the administration building. They just need the room tomorrow.
Okay.
They didn't tell me why.